This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio. I'm Sandy Billings. When we started our third season of Yin Radio on September 6, 2008, I kicked it off with everybody's favorite topic, sex. Today is an encore of that show, so I got sex for you today. First-time sex, and experienced sex, and sex in education, and sex in politics, abstaining from sex, and selling sex. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and we're talking about one of the most fascinating subjects in the world, sex. Installment number one does come from 1929. 1929 was an important year for sex in the United States. It was the year that Catherine Bemmett Davis overstepped her bounds by studying sexual behavior. Catherine Davis, okay, a respected graduate of Vassar, New York City Correction Commissioner in 1914. She was the first female head of a major municipal agency. And before that role, 13 years as superintendent at the state's Bedford Hills Reformatory for Women. But in 1929, she published the nation's first sex survey, before Kinsey and Masters and Johnson were even around to think about such things. It was called Factors in the Sex Life of 2,200 Women. From 1918 until 1928, for 10 years, as head of the Bureau of Social Hygiene, Dr. Davis worked to broaden the agency's focus beyond its original prime target of prostitution. Catherine Davis backed studies such as Women Police and Edith Spalding's experimental study of psychopathic delinquent women. Davis wanted to move beyond that, though, beyond studying criminal contact and law enforcement. She argued that if society wants to better understand behavior that's deviant from the norm, it had better first find out what constitutes the norm. Now, this notion is pretty deceptively simple and today seemingly self-evident, but it was extraordinarily bold and challenging at the time because the behavior that she had in mind to study was normal human sexuality. So she surveyed educated women using a written survey. And what was so important in Davis's study were its statistical indications that certain sexual practices and attitudes that previously were associated with marginal segments of society were in fact prevalent in mainstream womanhood. The Davis sex statistics meant that the definition of normal had to be reassessed when it came to women's sexuality. The Davis sex survey opened a field of inquiry for others to follow. It was the forerunner to the Kinsey Report and to the Masters and Johnson studies that now identify that field. Catherine Bemmett Davis wasn't the only woman mixing sex and politics, however, in 1929. So I have another story for you that is about additional efforts in 1929 from Mary Dennett. Mary Dennett intended only to educate her sons to become healthy and sexually grown men, but it became a political issue in her case as well. Louise Bernicow, she's the history columnist at Women's E-News, reads an article that she prepared about Mary Dennett making sex a political issue.
This is called Dennett's Pamphlet Made Sex a Political Issue, and it's a story about April 29th, 1929, sex education loses and government censorship wins. Her name was Mary Ware Dennett. She was 53 years old, a veteran of the fight for suffrage in Massachusetts and the nation, and a devoted anti-war activist who was divorced from an unapologetically unfaithful husband in a scandal that rocked proper Boston in 1912. Post-divorce, a single mother, and relocated to New York, she wrote something to help her two pre-adolescent boys learn about sex. It was a small pamphlet, 24 pages worth, of plain talk, in which she used the correct names for body organs, described intercourse and masturbation, and assured her boys that, quote, the climax of sex emotion is an unsurpassed joy, something which rightly belongs to every normal human being, a joy to be proudly and serenely experienced, unquote. What Bennett told her sons was one thing. What she told the public was another. Her pamphlet was loaned to other parents and then printed in a medical journal. She was deluged with requests, printed copies, and sold them to organizations like the YMCA. In 1922, the federal government clamped down. Authority for the clampdown was the 1873 Comstock Act, which made it a crime to send, quote-unquote, obscene materials through the U.S. mail. Although this was the end of the Roaring Twenties, with far more permissive attitudes toward sex than the Victoria era that had produced Comstock's legislation, the law was still on the books and was still used to censor people like birth control pioneer Margaret Sanger. Dennett, also a contraception proponent, refused to admit the government's authority in these matters and, defying the law, continued to reprint and send out thousands of copies of what came to be called the sex side of life. On April 29, 1929, a New York jury of 12 middle-aged white men found Dennett guilty, and she faced a 5-year prison term or a $5,000 fine. Vowing not to pay the fine or allow others to do so for her, she publicly protested the idiocy, as she said, of laws which makes truth criminal. Her attorney, Morris Ernst of the American Civil Liberties Union, working without a fee, insisted that obscenity is a subjective thing. It exists in the minds of dirty vice hunters who are always looking for it. The public rallied to Mary Dennett's side and to the ACLU's fight against government censorship, broadening the free speech agenda to include sex education, which had not yet been thought of as political. A defense committee of over 50 prominent Americans raised funds for an appeal, and in January of the next year, Mary Dennett was vindicated and the conviction overturned. Having established a landmark for free speech, she went on to work for peace until she died in 1947.
Installment number 2, it's about that first time. This installment comes in 3 parts, and it's all about initiation into that club of sexuality. First, I'm going to introduce the topic.
Today we're talking about initiation into one particular club, though, the club of sexual beings. That first time is so often remembered with disappointment, but it is remembered. Now, your first time being treated as a sexual being is not necessarily the same time as the first time becoming sexual or sexually aware. I'm just going to talk about that just a little bit, because the first time I was treated as a sexual being, I was only 7. And having talked to many women, I have long believed that most women, or really girls, that is, are treated as sexual creatures long before they even become aware of sexuality. But I was 7. And I was camping with part of my extended family, and my 15-year-old uncle and I were playing some tickle games instead of going to sleep, like we were supposed to, and like my sisters were. But the parents stayed up and talked. And Uncle Timmy led us on a game of tickle that got nearer and nearer to private areas before he asked me to hold his member and telling me what it could do. And I wasn't afraid of him or of his equipment, but I wasn't a bit interested or curious. I was 7 years old, after all. But I did feel very uncomfortable because this was obviously dirty and it was a secret. So I wanted the game to stop and I rolled over and the game stopped. The event was really almost immemorable. For years, I just didn't even think of it. It just wasn't a big deal. But my memory was jogged like 9 years or so later when I was about 16 and I was about to see the grown Uncle Timmy again. And I remembered the camping trip and I remembered the night of tickle games, and with my close to adult understanding, I just gasped. I was like, oh my God, that's what he was doing. No way, I was only 7 years old. My memory, with some understanding and some surprise and disgust, which was still mingled with amusement, it all came rushing in. And after that, and forevermore since then, the event became memorable. But even when I saw Uncle Tim recently, now he's in his 50s and me in my 40s, he kind of remarks really slyly, "We used to have some fun when we were kids, didn't we?" And he still doesn't get it. It's like, "I was only 7, Tim." But silly boys, they often don't get it. Even when we're older and we're mutually interested, that experience of a sexual first time is stereotypically good for him and disappointing for her. It's almost universally a time of great confusion. We just did something secret, perhaps dirty or shameful, depending on your outlook. Perhaps it's fulfilling, perhaps really special. Most likely, it would kind of like taking a road trip on a rural back road. You kind of anticipate that small town that's marked on the map. It's your destination. It's a place to stop. It's enjoy your break. And you're always going, you know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Is it up around that bend? You're really anticipating maybe a few more miles. And then that small town, you blink your eyes, and you find you're driven right on through. That's what the first time can be like. And there's a website. It's called www.myfirsttime.com. It invites everybody to post stories of their first sexual experience. And judging by the entries, this isn't really a private thing because all kinds of stories are posted. Many attempt to be just titillating, and some are nearly pornographic. But the most interesting thing I noted in my brief scan of the stories posted there is how different men's and women's stories were. Because women talked about the events leading up to the act and their first time and how the relationship continued or didn't continue. Men talked about the sex itself, and sometimes very graphically. Men and women both did talk about it, and they talked about it, and they talk about it. Because we are, after all, sexual creatures, no matter how much some parts of us try to deny it in public. So that first time opens doors to a major part of ourselves. It's a part that probably has been waiting to be expressed. And everybody has a first time story. Even celibates have an almost first time story. So today we're going to share a few of those stories. Maybe you'll see some similarities with your story and know you're not alone. If your story has yet to be written, maybe you'll recognize what you do and you don't want in your first time story, and you'll take some lessons from others. Because the first time, it can be traumatic. It can be romantic. It can be disappointing. It can be really intriguing. It can be fulfilling. But whatever it was for you, surely it was memorable. And now we're going to go around town with a question that I asked at a party of young women. And the question was, who did you tell about your first time? After we listen to those stories, we'll go straight on to a story by Brittany Peralt with her story of her first time and her promise to wait.
Who did you tell about your first time?
Who did I tell about my first time? My roommate. I actually called her. I was looking for condoms in the grocery store, and I told her about it. So that was my first time. So my first time, I actually called my best friend. It was in high school. So called her freaking out on the phone.
Cool. Bye.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good to see you.
See you too.
I know I heard you asking earlier. I don't know. I don't know what good.
Oh, like I told everyone.
I don't know. Let me think about it for a minute.
Okay. Do you want to answer?
What is it?
Who did you tell?
It was the first time I ever blacked out, so I didn't really know for like 2 days.
That was a good answer.
Several little pain.
Wait, I know my answer.
We are slutty bitches. You know that, by the way.
I told the other couple who was in the back seat, probably.
Awesome.
Here.
Is he putting it in my voice?
Okay.
Again,
my
Who'd you tell about your first time?
Nobody. I didn't tell anybody. And I wasn't going to tell anybody. Did you do it?
I told my best friend.
This will give you, if you enter this code in.
Right after it happened.
Okay. So then you don't have to...
I told my, not really my best friend, but two of them, and then the other one that I was at her house because I had sex with a guy at the party when I was drunk for my first time. And so I told pretty much everybody that was there knew, and then, but I talked about it with my friend's mom as well. So, like, four people.
So everybody
in the whole entire house.
I made an announcement over the intercom at high school.
Yeah.
Is it going? Do I just talk?
Yeah.
I told my two girlfriends immediately after it happened, and they pretty much thought I was the stupidest person on the face of the earth.
Hey, me too.
Now we're going to hear from Brittany Perrault, who's going to talk about her first time. But Brittany, you're not going to talk so much about the time, but kind of what led up to it as far as where you were kind of mentally.
Right. When I was about 15, or I guess 14, my friends were pretty much all losing their virginities about then, and I really was just at a place where I wasn't ready to do that yet. I just felt that I really wanted something to help me not give in to the pressures that I was feeling. So for my 15th birthday, my dad gave me a promise ring, which I asked for, and him and my mom gave it to me. And it was something really special to me because it wasn't for me to wait until I was married, which most promise rings represent. It was really just to wait until I was ready and to not give in to temptation. And my dad just let me know that he was going to be the only man in my life at that time and that guys were going to come and go, but he would really be the one that was there for me in the end.
So I'm not familiar with promise rings. So is it, it's a symbol of a commitment to yourself in this case and or to the family?
Yeah. It's an actual ring that I wore on my ring finger, and I wanted to make a promise to myself for a little bit to help myself have a goal. So I told myself that I would wait until at least I was out of high school, and to me that seemed like a long ways away because I was 15, so I figured, you know, that's a, you know, long range goal. That's about 3 years away. You know, I can do that. And so it really was just a huge part of my life, and I was very open with it. And I'm pretty much sure everybody at school knew that that wasn't something that I was going to do. And no matter what you did, I wasn't going to give in. And so then after high school, came to college, and I felt like, should I make myself another goal or should I just see what happens? And I ended up going on the pill just because I figured I'm not going to be a virgin forever, so might as well be prepared. And I met my boyfriend my freshman year, and we waited about 4 months into our relationship, and he was really good about not pressuring me, and it wasn't something that was really necessary because, you know, it had been such a good value that I had for so long, and I wore that ring until I finally did the deed, I guess you could say. And it was, like you said, it was very romantic. You know, there's different ways and people experience everything differently, but I can say that mine was definitely a really special time because it was such a huge part of my life. Mm-hmm. And it was hard because I had worn that ring for so long that when I finally had sex, I didn't want to take the ring off. And so it was really weird too because the ring actually started getting tight on my finger right before about that month, you know, that I ended up losing my virginity. And it was just so crazy because I really can't wear it anymore after that. It really doesn't fit on my finger. So I thought, you know, it was a really special moment for me. And I have the ring still. I don't wear it anymore, but I think I want to keep it and maybe do that for when I have a daughter someday, because it really helped me to have something with me at all times to look at and to remember when I got the ring and know that that isn't something that I'm ready to do just yet and to wait. And I'm still with my boyfriend almost 3 years now, and he's the only person that I've been with, and I think that it was just a really good thing for me.
I was going to ask you, or at least comment on what you said in the beginning about all your friends losing their virginity and the pressure. I mean, that's kind of like the welcome to the club. It's kind of like you're expected to join the club. And you know, that's not different from my experience, you know, a whole generation different from your time. It's really interesting that things haven't changed all that much, is in that regard, at least. There's a lot of pressure. Everybody's doing it. And the pressure is really subtle. Nobody's saying, why haven't you? Well, maybe a few are. But right. It's just that that's part of the growing up at that time. And with everyone around you doing it, it's a conversation you can't really join in
right
until you've done it. So I think it's really interesting that you found a way to recognize that you get to make that choice. You don't have to make it because of pressure from either an individual or from your general social circle.
Right. I think that's something I would highly recommend to parents out there that have teenage daughters. I think that, you know, it's an awkward stage for, you know, girls, and they don't want to listen to their parents, and they're going to do whatever they want to do anyways. Yeah. But to have something like that, it was really, really amazing to be able to look at that, and it really became a part of me. And yeah. I really, really recommend having some kind of a symbol, maybe not a ring, but something that can help that person not give in.
It also reminds me of things that I'm just learning now in my 40s about just knowing my own mind and deciding what I want to do. It's not that having sex at that time is wrong in and of itself. It's what was wrong for you.
Right.
And it was important to know your own mind and make your own decision. And boy, that can be hard to make your own decision when you're 14, 15, and 16, not
Definitely.
To mention when you're 25 and 35 and 45. That's great.
Thank you.
Tell me, who did you tell? Are you going to share that part with us?
I believe I called my best friend and pretty much told all of my friends, because they had all been waiting for me. And then, of course, I told my parents, because, of course, I wanted to let them know. And when I saw them from coming home from break and I wasn't wearing the ring anymore, it kind of spoke for itself. But, yeah, everybody was waiting, so I had to let everybody know that now I was part of the club.
Yeah. I'll ask you one more question along these lines. Do you think that we're really different after that first time?
You know, I don't think so. I think maybe mentally you may feel that you're at a different place. I think maybe depending on your situation and how you ended up losing it. But yeah, I think maybe mentally you may think that you're in a different place. But I think it just depends, really. Yeah.
I find that I didn't feel like I was a different person. I didn't, you know, this whole big deal about whether I'm a virgin or not. Was I really different? No. But it is interesting that there's some subtle difference about your outlook. And maybe you can say you're a woman when you get your period, but I think I felt more like a woman once I became sexually active.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us.
That was Brittany Perrault. She was the Yin Radio intern in the spring of 2007, and we had that conversation on the air on the February 1st, 2007 Yin Radio show about initiation. When we talk about sex, we have to talk about not having sex. So for more expertise, let's hear from nuns. First, Sister Carol Ann Wasmuth of St. Gertrude's in Cottonwood, Idaho. She entered the convent at age 13. That's very young, even for the 1940s. But she had lots of time to consider monastic life before she made the final commitment to celibacy.
I was in the community for almost 10 years before I could make any kind of final commitment, so I had plenty of time to think about it. I don't think at the beginning it was that much of a question for me, just because I was so busy having fun teaching those kids and doing all that kind of stuff. There was a time in my life when, yes, I questioned the whole celibacy thing and really started getting in touch with my own sexuality. But I think we had some very healthy input on that. You know, it wasn't like denying your sexuality. It was like looking at it and saying, okay, how do I express my sexuality? And one of the things that I realized, especially once I started working in parishes, is that I am a very strong heterosexual. You know, because that's a whole gamut, you know, and you fall somewhere on this gamut. You know, some people are stronger than other, and I am a very strong heterosexual, which simply to me means I need, in order to be healthy, I need to have interaction with men. You know, and seeing in the parish, that was no problem. I worked side by side with a lot of men and interacted with them and taught them and, you know, was on committees with them and the whole thing and had good men friends there. And see, that's the thing I really start realizing, that if I was going to be healthy, I needed to develop healthy relationships with men as well as women. They don't need to be sexual, or, well, I guess, they're always, but they don't need to be genital. I mean, you know, they can be good, healthy relationships, and that's how I would remain healthy. And when I came back to the monastery, that was, oh dear, I mean, there aren't a lot of men running around here. But then I got involved in the forest management and work with a lot of men there, and we've just gotten to be good friends, and I keep up my relationship and friends with, my friendship with the men that I knew, as well as the women. I mean, I just have very good friends, both in community, but outside community as well. And so, it's kind of funny because, of, you know, 30, 40 years ago, I'd have never believed I'd be doing this because life was very different at that time. But I have a good friend, a gentleman who used to live here at Winchester. We got to know each other when we worked together on human rights issues and worked together with the Nez Perce tribe. And he's since moved to Boise, and we stay in touch. And when I go to Boise for business or whatever, I always let him know I'm coming, and we figure out a night, and he comes, picks me up, and we go out and have a glass of wine and have dinner and have a marvelous conversation. And, I mean, it's as close to a date as you can get. I mean, it is. It's a beautiful experience, you know, and it's a great time. I thoroughly enjoy it, and he brings me back and back to my friends or wherever I'm staying. And it's something I need. And I think he also, it's a good experience for him too. And the thing is, we both know, and my other men friends too, that it's never going to develop into anything else. It is just a simple friendship where we can share ideas and share, you know, fun together, and just let it be at that. And so, I think a good part of this is, it kind of slips back to what I just said, a healthy recognition of who we are and our own sexuality. And yes, I can't deny that, and I can't suppress it, and I can't say that there's anything wrong with it. I simply need to find ways that are healthy, that fit into my lifestyle, where I can take care of that need for intimacy, for that kind of friendship.
Thubten Chödrön, an American Buddhist nun in the Tibetan tradition, echoed Sister Carol Ann's sentiments.
It's actually so nice to be celibate, because I find that my relationship with men is just so much easier now. You know, because I know I don't want to get involved. They know I'm not going to get involved. So then I can relate to men in a really frank, direct way without all this. I mean, you know how you use your eyes and how you walk and this and that and the other thing to try and attract. So you don't have to bother with any of that anymore. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's really rather nice.
Thubten Chödrön knows what she's talking about from direct experience. Years before finding Tibetan Buddhism and choosing monastic life, she was married. Now, this is Yin Radio, and today we are talking about sex. It's an encore show from September 2008. We are at installment number 4. Author Susan Power has a book in progress called Our Lady of the New World. The concept for the novel came to her while she was brushing her teeth. The main character is a wealthy, thin, pampered, and unhappy white woman who is part Indian, Native American Indian, that is. In this installment, Susan's reading a chapter from the book called Queen of the Heavens. This chapter is told by an old Ojibwe woman, a maid to the rich, sad lady, while they are working together in the kitchen. The Ojibwe woman is responding to her employer's question, "Were you ever married?" When we join the reading, the maid has already described her first husband. It was a bad marriage, in which she was bound unhappily until his early death. But after he died, she fell in love, the right way.
My heart noticed him one winter at a memorial feast, my husband's. I was the young widow, dressed in all my layers of clothes to keep out the chill. Cold wind outside the tribal hall, colder wind inside me, freezing my blood. I was not made to pretend, and that is all I had been doing for 1 year, pretending to miss the one who trapped me, until sometimes I felt more dead than he was. Then, my mind switched on like the twist of a lantern. Flames leaped, awareness. Abraham sat with the other old uncles and grandfathers, all of them teasing and boasting, reminiscing. The others had children and grandchildren they could have reached for, summoned from across the room. Only Abraham was a tree without branches beyond the square tips of his fingers. I saw him as if for the first time, in a bubble of light, soft, hazy. His smooth skin was dark as a muddy river, but unlike the other Ojibwe men, he was near bald, his silver-black hair no more than the soft fuzz of a newborn. His cheekbones were bright, polished knobs. His smile seemed latched on. All his wrinkles framed that smile, the one that touched a match to his soul and lit him up until he shone. My fingers were laced together in my lap, but I lifted them to peek at Abraham through their design, become a net. I will go fishing soon, I said to myself quietly, a promise. A few days later, I brought him a present, maple candy I'd made just for him, thinking sweet thoughts as I did the work. Uncle, I rapped on the door of his small shed of a house. Yes? He opened the door, and heat from his stove and his smile blasted into me, through me. A fire ghost lit me like a candle. His world smelled delicious, a wood smoke incense that swirled around my head, making me dizzy. He helped me sit at his table, took the parcel of candy from me, and removed my gloves. He held my hands then between his own, concern showing on his face. Oh, those hands weren't skin, crude flesh. My Abraham was softer than velvet suede, smooth as satin, but warmer, satin with a heartbeat. I want to glide you, was the only ridiculous thing I could say. And instead of laughing or pushing me out of his house, he pulled a chair beside me and sat with me, holding my hand. My new clumsy bear of love sprawled over us both. He waited. He let things develop. When I could finally speak and explain my crazy quilt of feelings, beg to look after him, be with him, he listened respectfully and didn't let my words wash him away, though they were a dangerous, unexpected flood like a rising creek. When I was done, not finished, neat with conclusion, but tipped empty, he sighed. You know, I had a dream when I was little that I would be everyone's uncle, their counselor and friend, their old tree that is always there for shelter and support no matter what else changes. But near the end of the dream, it all flipped over, and instead of my arms cradling the world was cradling me, and I woke up so happy I thought I must have died. Ogiman Gishigukwe, I don't know why you look at me with love eyes when you are queen of the sky, but I think my dream was telling me to wait for you. And I did. I listened. I am 70 years old by the Chimukuman calendar, and I have never touched a woman in a way that said, I am a man. I saved my touches for you. My girlfriend snickered behind my back, looked at me cross-eyed when they heard the news that Abraham was my new husband. I didn't care. I laughed into my hands, rich with delicious secrets, love snacks. When a man has waited for you since before you were born, and then finds you in his bed, in his lap, wound so snug and perfect against his body, you are two strands of yarn become one stitch. His desire is more than a pond or a creek or even a great lake, more than an ocean. He is the flood that kept Noah paddling the globe in his crowded boat. He is the rain poured heavy from every cloud, morning tears squeezed from every flower. Okay, I'm going to take a break because I have to. I always get hot during this section. Okay. Okay. His love juice is shocking, limitless. You begin to think he will populate a new planet if you give him half the chance. You forget that he is old because his manly parts have had a lifetime of rest without recreation. And so he is a soldier down there, trained not by practice, but by years of imagining. Think of it. When my Abraham touched me, he worked a magic of opposites. How could he be so gentle? The pressure of a thumb wisps soft as the nap of a butterfly wing. And still, at the same time, so warmly focused, intent, packed dense with delight, that touch was penetrating as if I was no more than warm butter. Oh, he melted my shoulder with his hot mouth and busy swiping tongue, and the brown acorns of my nipples, and the deep swirl of my navel, and the dark roses that led inside me. I'll skip a little bit here because I know this is going to be on the radio. Was I still a woman beneath his hands and lips? He helped me lose myself, my edges, so that I opened up into him, and through him, I opened to the world. And what about Abraham, you might be wondering? Was he happy too? Every time I kissed a section of his land, the country of his flesh, I was whispering in my head, I love you. I love you. My thoughts worked their way into his trusting form. He heard me, all of me, and so our bodies learned to speak the same language. We created poetry good enough to last the ages. Whenever I led him to the burst open dam of pleasure, danced and sang him there with love and vigor, he roared with laughter, showing all his teeth. Does everyone know such moments of joy? I hope so. I hope they have a treasure like mine, two fistfuls of my man's laugh, each one a diamond. Okay, and now I'm going to skip several pages. They have a very happy life together. So remember, this is all in response to that question, were you ever married? So that's one husband dead, then the other one who's already much older than her, he dies of old age. Then she has a much younger husband who's a different tribe, and then he is killed. So, yeah, she's had several husbands. But I'm skipping to the end of this chapter. And she's talking about the fact that she's never going to get married again. That's enough. Well, I'll let her say, what does she say about that? When we buried him, I told his spirit to look out for Abraham. This is her other good husband. Because I thought the two of them could be friends, the kind of relative you have a joking relationship with to avoid any tension. I imagined them competing for my attention in a teasing way once I joined them. Wouldn't I be the lucky one with two husbands, old and young, to warm my front and my back at the same time? I won't get married anymore, I promised them, since where would I fit another down by my feet where he'd have to curl like a dog? No, that's enough, I said. I'm done. So I haven't married anymore. That doesn't mean I've given up on love. the romantic kind. Just last year, I found myself a boyfriend at the University of St. Thomas Powwow, hosted right before Christmas. I noticed an old whiskered man watching our doings with a fierce fascination. He sat forward in his chair, leaning onto a cane he held with both his hands. He rapped that cane in time to the music, matching every drum stroke if it was a slow number and just a heavy downbeat if the song was fast. He wasn't simply an audience member settled on the edge of our celebration, our performance. He was a participant without ever rising to his feet. I came to learn that this was how Yuri lived in the world, his eyes and mouth and hands, large and hungry, latched onto everything. I don't mean to say he was greedy, just willing to eat whatever life set in front of him. I presented myself to him at the dinner break, shook his hand, welcomed him to our gathering. Only then did I notice the young man seated beside him, pale as skim milk, his eyes as dark with rings as a raccoon's. Thin blonde hair was pasted like loose threads to his skull. "This is my grandfather," the young man explained. "He's from Russia, St. Petersburg. He doesn't speak any English. His name is Yuri. Mine is Sergei." The grandson turned out to be a scholarship student at the university, a cleric in training. He'd found a family to sponsor his grandfather, bring him to the States, because the two men had only each other in the world. Yuri had worked most of his life in a bottle factory, but his true vocation, the art God gave him, was blowing glass. Sergei talked and talked about the miracle of things that were both liquid and solid, about the deaths of their relatives, about loneliness and God. I half listened, nodding at his large sunken eyes every now and then, but noticing Yuri the whole time, how he cocked his head to the side during his grandson's speech as if he understood. I later learned that Yuri did understand what people said, not always the words, seldom the words, but the fruit pit, the marrow of their meaning. After a while, I shooed Sergei off so I could sit with Yuri and talk to him in our private way that worked so well for us. I didn't tell him my Chimukuman name, Gladys, but my real one, Hogiman Kishikukwe. To share the meaning, I made the sign with my hands of a shapely woman, the hourglass curves. Then I pointed to the sky and opened my arms wide to indicate the vault of heaven. He nodded, growled his own words in a raw, burned voice. Yuri was all silver hair and big teeth like those polar bears I've seen on television. He had that same quality of suspended power, terrific energy stored up and waiting for release. We became friends. We became lovers. He would speak to me with his hands and his zigzag Russian words. I would answer him with my own dramatic fingers and vivid Anishinaabe Moen. He was born in the revolution year, I came to understand, and had lived a life that was like climbing and then sliding down the faces of great mountains, up and down, loving people, losing people, sharing stories, keeping secrets. Sometimes we pressed our foreheads together and spoke with our eyes, our thoughts. I never knew people could communicate in so many ways when they couldn't rely on words. Sergei would drop Yuri off at my apartment for however long we'd arranged. I'd feed him, and we'd talk our more than talk. Then we'd let our bodies bring us even closer. I never actually shared my bed with Yuri. Arthritis worked on him, turning him to stone, so it was easier to leave him sitting in an old ladder-back chair empty of arms. And when he rested his cane on the floor and held out his hands to me, I would arrange us so that I straddled his lap, and we were joined, still clothed. Because my plain grandma dress hid our activity, covered our yin and yang, it made our love even more exciting. We were like two kids hiding in a closet or the stall of a barn, desperate to do our business, but having to be quick and sneaky. Yuri's arms were so strong he could lift me up and down, bounce me like a baby. Hoppa, hoppa, hoppa was his happy rhythmic noise. And after our joyous bumpy ride, better than any I'd ever tested at the state fair, we would collapse against one another, breathless but smiling, locked together on that chair. We became one round body with all those arms and legs, a big love bug in my kitchen. We relished the minutes we were able to stay connected if we held still, very still. Our old bodies merged continents. We were a testament to how much people can live through without giving up. Yuri died just 6 months after we met, fiercely alive until the last minute, watching the news with his grandson and shouting at Donald Rumsfeld. Sergei brought me a gift he said his grandfather wanted me to have after his death. He handed me a small wooden box. "Careful," he warned, as I lifted the lid and dug through old-time Excelsior to find the object. My hand closed on a smooth globe the size of my fist. I gently lifted it from its nest. The gift was a bubble of clear glass that tinkled softly, faint as the ring of spirit bells. I held up the globe to the light and saw that there were seven in all, one inside another, each smaller, just like those Russian dolls. They were seven glass pearls without any flaw that I could see, no seams or bubbles. This was his life's work. Sergei explained, it took him years to get it right, managed to fit them all together without breaking a single orb. I hadn't cried when I learned my friend had died because there was nothing to grieve or regret. But now I felt tears burning my eyes, saw the glass planets as his honest spirit resting in my palm. He had somehow captured the likeness of all our spirits, the miracle artwork that is our soul, both fragile and strong, perfect and beautiful, and beautiful and beautiful.
That was Susan Power reading a chapter from her upcoming novel, Our Lady of the New World.
So very beautiful.
And we're going to wrap up today's show with a piece called Reporting from the Red Light District. Jessica Partnow prepared this report in 2006.
On my 25th birthday, there were a lot of things I'd never done. It was 2 months ago, and I'd flown into Bangkok with my friends Sarah and Alex to embark on the Common Language Project, a media collective we'd formed to cover positive and underreported international news for independent media sources. All of us were new to this business of running a nonprofit. There were a lot of things none of us had ever done. I had never spent time in a third world slum. I had never walked through a minefield. I had never talked to a prostitute. There were mundane things, too. I had never run a website, or ridden a motorbike, or produced a radio piece, or not complained about having to wake up early for work every morning. But by last week, I thought I'd taken all these new experiences pretty well in stride. I've kept an open mind and allowed my initial impressions and prejudices to shift as we cover each story. We all have. Our mantra on the project has become, let the story write itself. Don't force it to fit your expectations. But feminism was one thing I thought I'd had all figured out. I've called myself a feminist for as long as I can remember. In college, I took women's studies classes, read, and at least claimed to understand, Andrea Dworkin, debated the merits of third wave feminism, and could give you a perfectly good academic explanation of power structures that create a market for trafficked women. So when Sarah and Alex and I got ready to cover a story about Calcutta's red light district, I figured we had it written before we'd even arrived. I knew what we were going to find. Women as victims of a sexist system, desperately struggling to escape the bonds of prostitution, making just enough money to live without any hope of escape, and the amazing NGO that has sprung up in their midst to save them. Yes, prostitution was bad, I thought, and New Light, the NGO we'd be talking to, was good. End of story. We'd be in and out of there in an afternoon. On day one, I'm walking down an alley in Kaligat, near one of the holiest Hindu temples in all of India. I've read about this alley in the newspaper. The New York Times article that inspired us to come here in the first place described it as fetid, a slum, one of the worst places on earth. And yes, as I'm walking, I'm being careful to avoid the open sewers, averting my eyes because I can see into people's bedrooms, see people bathing at the water pump on the street. I glimpse a brown river of garbage and mud at the end of the lane. I keep thinking I see a curtain being drawn across a room by a prostitute with a new client. I'm taking all of this in. But after an afternoon of serious horseplay with prostitutes' children, who spend their evenings at New Light while their mothers are working, when the three of us sit down over beers, what we're talking about is not desperation or poverty, but the incredible community we saw and the sense of autonomy we felt from the women of Kaligat.
I mean, what did one of the women we interviewed say? She was like, having a bad reputation is a hell of a lot better than having a great reputation and getting beaten every day by your husband.
Hello.
Right, or being a slave in your in-laws' house.
I can't think of anything more true than that. You know, and like, how revolutionary is that?
Yeah.
That you just throw off all of the shackles of social expectations.
It was during conversations like that one that my feminist conscience started getting nervous. This was going against every instinct in me, but maybe, was it possible? Could it be that prostitution isn't all that bad? Could it, given a little more recognition and improved conditions, be a valid and valuable profession? Blasphemy. Prostitution is oppressive to women. It's damaging, and it's indicative of all the larger systems of sexism in society. What kind of feminist am I? All those people we saw are pimps and prostitutes, I reminded myself, desperately trying to fit what I'd seen back into my comfortable stereotype, desperately trying to deny the sinking realization that there was no way this was going to be a one-day story. The problem was that I'd been expecting ravaged faces with the dark circles of drug addiction and hopelessness, women slumped in their hovels in misery, pimps controlling the big money and forcing girls to work for next to nothing. I was expecting to be scared and horrified. I was expecting to feel pity. The problem was that I was not expecting my biggest challenge to be getting over my own hang-ups about sex in order to ask these women frank questions about their work. When I met Sunita the next day, I finally threw out my expectations and started to let the blasphemy in. She's about 40, a little chubby, with a grin that takes up her whole face and feet that swing a good 3 inches above the floor when she sits in a chair. She looks a lot like a middle-aged housewife, but she's worked as a prostitute in Calcutta for the past 20 years and still earns as much as younger women, seeing about 5 clients a day and earning the going rate of 50 rupees, or about $1, per client. She laughs as she recounts the story of being kidnapped on her way to work when she was 16. She woke up in a brothel in New Delhi, but when she saw all the girls lined up in their red saris and pretty gold jewelry, she thought it was a wedding party. She escaped that brothel only to be forced into another one. This time she got away by jumping out of a second-story window while the madam was sleeping. She had no idea where she was, and strangers helped treat her bleeding and swollen knees and get her back to Calcutta.
I found work as a housemaid, but the head of the house immediately made sexual advances towards me. Wherever I went, I was asked to sleep around. Eventually, I decided to become a sex worker. If everyone is trying to sleep with me anyway, I might as well earn some money.
As we talked to Sunita, my fears about asking questions about how much she made or what her job was like started to seem silly. She wasn't ashamed to talk about her life, so why was I feeling ashamed for her? She told us about running into the man who had sold her to the brothel in Delhi.
One day, while I was working in the city, I saw one of the guys who sold me talking to another girl. I followed them, and he took the girl into a restaurant. I told the manager, "I know this guy. He sold me as a slave. He's trying to do the same to this girl." The manager called the police, and they arrested him. I went to the police headquarters, and they questioned me about what happened. He threatened me, saying he was going to come and slash my cheeks with a razor. But he went to jail.
We asked her if she'd seen conditions for women in the neighborhood improve over the past 10 years.
"Now my co-workers are more aggressive. We take care of each other if anything happens, and it's much safer now."
She talks about her entry into the profession as a choice at times, but adds that she didn't have many options.
"I'm illiterate. If I had known education would make things better for me, I would have made different choices. But now it's too late. I'm 40 years old, and there's no point."
The daughters of women like Sunita will have more options than she did. At New Light's Shoma Memorial Girls' Home, 15 girls from Kaligat, on the verge of entering the trade themselves, instead take traditional dance and computer lessons, prepare for a trip to Darjeeling, and attend school regularly. If they do choose to follow in their mother's footsteps, as New Light staff and mothers are quick to mention, it will be by choice, and they will do so on their own terms. Another group a few miles north is organizing to make sure that happens. At midnight on May 1st, sex workers in Sonagachi, another infamous red light district, organized a rally to demand recognition for their work as a viable profession, fair wages, and protection from exploitation, trafficking, and slavery. Heading to the protest, I'm buoyant with my newfound analysis of the sex trade, ready to be floored by the most progressive feminist ideology I've ever heard. And then I walk by a doorway lined with 11-year-old girls in bright lipstick and platform shoes. I start to feel sick as I picture a member of the religious right watching this scene over my shoulder. These women are burning George W. Bush in effigy so that they can keep selling little girls into sex slavery? I stammer something back about the oldest profession, the possibility that some women are here by choice, that empowering sex workers means they'll use condoms. But I feel ashamed. Ashamed that I so easily turned on my own beliefs. Ashamed that a group I'd so proudly heralded as the new feminists are marching through these same streets, seeing these same children in the same doorways. I'm remembering that things are always much more complicated than you want them to be. But these women aren't all wrong. As they march through the streets, demanding their rights, insisting that their honest day's work is just as honest as mine, I have to agree. I have to stop insisting that it's possible to have any given issue completely figured out. I just have to let this one write itself.
This piece was produced by the Common Language Project, with narration by Jessica Partnow, production by Alex Stonehill, and music by Mile Marker and Chez Rock. For more of our work, please visit www.commonlanguageproject.net.
Jessica Partnow reporting for the Common Language Project, clpmag.org. The topic has been sex. It's an encore from September 2008. And I'll be leaving you with some music from Poxville, and it's a song called Make Believe. You can listen to past shows, podcast this show, or sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and it's heard on a number of really cool community radio stations in this country. This show is produced by Brittany Peralt, Jessica Partnow, and Sandy Billings. Opening music is Smell of the Sea by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, the executive producer and host. And happy graduation to Yin Radio assistant producer Anna Maria Roque, who's earned her bachelor's in journalism and mass communication, and to accounting intern Seema Bassi, getting her PhD in accounting, and to all you graduates celebrating this month. I'm glad you joined me.